The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is March the 19th. Let the record reflect that there's a quorum present. I'm looking around. We're waiting for Senator Ortman to get here to take up Senator Scheid's DNA collection bill. I don't see Senator Pappas. So, Senator Scheid, why don't we take your other two bills?
660-27. Madam Chair, absolutely.
And then Senator Betzel's on deck.
Madam Chair, do you want to do 2660? I don't know which order you have it.
2663.
I have it in numericals. Yep. 2663. There you are.
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, quickly, move to delete Section 1.
Senator Betzel moves to delete Section 1. Senator Scheid, any objections?
Madam Chair, I just have to... I think that that's... Oh, Madam Chair. I understand.
Any discussion?
I wholeheartedly support that.
Ms. Schillen, is there a specific reason why that statement is in there? Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I mean, most of it, virtually all of it, is currently in statute. So the only new language to this purpose and intent paragraph is the last line and a half.
It's already in law. I wish I could repeat it.
Oh, let's hear from the witness. Counsel cautions me that there may be a very specific reason why that language is there.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Alyssa Shalander. I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. No, there isn't a very specific reason why that language is there. And while I would like to retain Section 1 of the law, we could do without Section 1 of the bill.
Very good. On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Anything else, Senator Betzel?
I don't know what the rest of the bill says, but that part caught my attention.
Well, Madam Chair, no.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, yes. This bill...
Senator Scheid, there's an A2 amendment. Would you like to...
Yes,
oh, it's,
yes.
But it can't be an author's
it
amendment.
It wouldn't be an author's amendment,
all right, so,
Madam Chair. So let me describe this. And, in fact, in order to move things more quickly, I think I'll have Ms. Schlander tell you where we are now, because I... This is one of those...
This is it for the day.
Yeah. One of those
work
things...
Work in progress.
This has to... Well, and, Madam Chair, I think it's been worked out. And so
very
that's...
Good.
That's the good news. This bill came to me from the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, and hoping for some kind of a lifeline for the employees who lost their jobs over the General Motors and Chrysler bankruptcies. This would deal with their franchise contracts so to create a more level playing field. And we know we often have that conversation about this and other kinds of franchise agreements. But I'm looking for my notes that tell me where we have the agreement. And I'm sorry, I've done something here with that. So why don't I let Ms. Schlander start with where we are in the bill now, and then we'll tell you what about the amendment.
Ms. Schlander.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. the bill that we have before you, the most important part of the bill is to extend a lifeline to the 60 Minnesota dealerships that were terminated when General Motors and Chrysler filed for bankruptcy last summer. Although General Motors has started to reinstate some of those dealers, what this bill would do is it is a very modest proposal to just give those terminated dealers the right of first offer in the event that General Motors or Chrysler intends to reestablish a dealership in the market area where they formerly terminated someone last summer in the hasty decisions that were made during the bankruptcy proceedings in June. Basically, what the most important part of the bill says is that those folks get the right of first offer. However, that is not absolute. The manufacturers do have some protections in that section. If the dealer is not qualified to be a dealer anymore, if they don't have the proper financing in place, if they're somehow not fit to own the dealership, they certainly. The manufacturer certainly does have the discretion to not offer them the franchise back. And also, this is for a limited period of time, just recognizing that when General Motors and Chrysler went through bankruptcy in June, they were two of the largest industrial bankruptcies of all time, and they were both completed in a matter of about 40 days each. So there were quite a lot of hasty decisions made. So this just gives those dealers that were terminated through no fault of their own and not because of their own business failings, just gives them a bit of a lifeline to be first in line should those franchises open in those areas again. So as Senator Scheid was saying, the dealers and the auto manufacturers are really the only interest groups that have a stake in this legislation, and we have worked out all of our points of controversy with the A2 amendment. We should have no more opposition to the bill.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Any questions on the A2 amendment, members? Any discussions on Senator Scheid's motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. And members, I think that's the bill. Mm-hmm. Is there anybody here who would like to be heard on Senate File 2663?
Madam Chair, good morning. I'm Sandy Naren. I'm here on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. The Alliance is a trade association of 10 of the largest car manufacturers in the world. And I do want to thank Ms. Schlander and Senator Scheid for working with us on this language over the last month or so. We have worked out all of our differences, and my client, the Trade Association, is neutral on this bill. We don't have any opposition to it. I do want to mention to the committee, however, that the Section 7, I think it is, of the bill, the operative one that that Alyssa just mentioned that deals with the bankruptcy situation. Four states have passed similar legislation to this section. All four of those states have been joined in a lawsuit in federal bankruptcy court in New York. Chrysler Motor Company is challenging the constitutionality of this provision and say it violates the bankruptcy court order. So it is likely, I don't know for sure what Chrysler will do, but it is likely that Minnesota may be joined in this lawsuit if this provision does pass. So I do need to at least give you notice that that may happen.
Any questions for Ms. Naren? Thank you very much. Anybody else like to be heard on Senate File 2663? Seeing none, Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 2663 as amended be recommended to pass. Any discussions on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
And Madam Chair, I want to thank Ms. Schlander and Ms. Naren for all the work they put into it. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, Senate File 2704. Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
This bill is about a topic that I'd not heard of when it was brought to me, and it has to do with funding. It's a non-recourse loan. I was going to say it isn't a loan, but it's a non-recourse loan that is made to litigants, to plaintiffs in a lawsuit. Well, it wouldn't have to be just plaintiffs, but to parties in a lawsuit who may need to pay the mortgage, maybe because of their injury, they are not able to work, or they're working less, they need money for the house payment or whatever, can't be used for, well, I don't know, that there's no law right now regarding it, or no statutory requirements of this kind of lending. And I'm going to have Mr. Schuler, who represents an organization of a number of companies that provide this kind of lending or funding, to describe to you how it works. And the fact is, we're saying we want to know who these players are. There's a packet that was handed out actually by Mr. Johnson of the Insurance Federation. I don't know if you're going to get that or not, but there's a lot of this going on, and it's totally unregulated. If you do have this packet, none of the companies in the packet are represented by Mr. Schuler here. I think we want to know who the companies are, and the bill also offers some excellent disclosure, and that's very important so that parties do understand what their options may be. There are some issues that have to do with attorney-client, because, as you know, the attorneys cannot lend money to a client, and getting them into the middle of that transaction is a little dicey, and I think that the parties have agreed they need to work on that aspect of it. But I think it's important for consumer protection that we instill some regulation. So with that, I introduce Mr. Eric Schuler.
Mr. Schuler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Eric Schuler, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Oasis Legal Finance. Happy to be back here today in Minnesota, and in fact, I grew up in Brooklyn Center. Oasis is based in Northbrook, Illinois, and has been in operation for 7 years. I'm here today on behalf of the American Legal Finance Association to provide testimony for you for consideration on SF-2704. Oasis is part of the legal funding industry. Legal funding is a term used to describe the process whereby funds are paid to an individual who has filed a civil claim or lawsuits. The funds provided are used by the individual to pay for basic living necessities such as housing, car payments, or just putting food on the table. As we stated, we have offered an amendment that just states that these funds for the consumer are not to be used to cover legal expenses in the case. These funds are provided on a non-recourse basis and are repaid at the time the case settles on the proceeds of the claim. If the case is lost or settlement monies are insufficient to repay the amounts funded, the individual owes nothing in return. At no time do we take a percentage of the settlement amount. I would also like the committee to know that since 2004, Oasis has done about 600 cases in the state, with the average funding being about $1,700 and not tens of thousands of dollars. The industry average for the state of Minnesota is about $4,000. We fund just enough to give the consumer the ability to make the mortgage payment, pay their utilities, and also to put food on the table. We have provided you some testimonials on how this product has helped consumers. The average consumer that we are funding does not have access to credit. Their home equity line may have been cut, and they cannot borrow funds for friends or family, as most of them are also hurt by this economy. Oasis did a survey about 3 years ago, and we found that most of the Oasis applicants are less than 44 years of age, lower to middle income. Majority of the households earn less than $40,000, with 34% earning less than $20,000. And most of them do not have access to bank credit cards. We are paid an agreed-to fee, and that fee alone. We never take a percentage of the case. And to clarify this point, we have also amended the bill that states just that. It will not take a percentage of the recovery, the underlying claim, and only the contracted amount. By way of introduction, the American Legal Finance Association, also known as ALFA, is a group of 21 civil litigation funding companies doing business across the United States. One of ALFA's first projects was to establish industry standards for the legal funding industry, especially regarding transparency in transactions and clear disclosures to the consumer. As a founding member of ALFA, Oasis and the 20 other member companies abide by this set of practices, but not every funding company is a member of ALFA. This is one of the main reasons for ALFA's urging a passage of this legislation. We know that there are companies out there that do not follow our set of best practices, and as a result, the consumer may have a bad experience with one of them. We want to ensure that every consumer in Minnesota is treated fairly, and ALFA was formed in 2004 and dedicated to ensuring fair, ethical, and transparent funding in the legal funding industry. Senate File 2704 seeks to protect the consumer and regulate the legal funding providers. I just want to give you a quick breakdown of some of the protections in the legislation. Section 3 requires a registration process with the Minnesota Department of Commerce. The commissioner will now have the authority to review, enforce regulations regarding the legal funding industry, and this regulation will be funded by fees paid by the legal funding industry. Section 5 outlines various consumer protections in the contract between the consumer and the legal funding company to include a 5-business-day right to cancel the transaction. One of the more important aspects of the bill and contract contained is a 12-point boldface font that the Civil Litigation Funding Company agrees that they shall have no right and will not make any decisions with respect to the conduct of the underlying civil action or claim and or settlement or resolution of it, and that the right to make those decisions solely remain with you and your attorney in the civil claim or action. This means that once we give the funding to the consumer, we have no influence over the case whatsoever. Further consumer protections in Section 6 prohibit the Civil Litigation Funding Company from paying a fee or commission to an attorney, medical provider, or physical therapist, and also prohibits the Civil Litigation Funding from accepting commissions or referral fees from attorneys, medical providers, or chiropractors, or physical therapists. It also prohibits the Civil Litigation Funding Company from advertising or making false, intentional, misleading information regarding their product or service. Madam Chair and members, I'd like to thank you for your attention to the legal funding industry, and I ask for your favorable vote on this legislation, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Betzel?
Thank you, Mr. Schuller. And I'm sorry, sir, I didn't catch your last name again.
Eric Schuller.
Schuller, Mr. Schuller. What kinds of cases generally are we talking about here? Are these like personal injury cases? I realize it could be any kind of cases, but there must be some of more than others. What kind of cases are we talking about?
Mr. Schuller.
Madam Chair, majority of them are personal injury cases.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Schuller, just so I understand it, basically you've got somebody who's got a personal injury lawsuit going on. They've probably gotten an attorney, usually, who's going to handle this on a contingent fee basis. But what this would do is you'd be loaning money to the plaintiff, the individual who's bringing the lawsuit, for matters that are unrelated to the lawsuit, but you'd be loaning money with the idea that you'd be getting an assignment, a claim against whatever judgment or settlement the individual ultimately gets out of the court. Is that a quick summary of what this is about?
Mr. Schuller.
Madam Chair, correct. And most times when people are involved in personal injury suits, their ability to work is reduced, especially if they're living directly from paycheck to paycheck. And majority of the cases that come to us, but time difference from the time of incident or time of accident to the time of funding, in a majority of the cases, it's at least 6 months or more, meaning that that person has pretty much exhausted every means that they've had up until that point. In other words, they've gone to family, they've gone to friends, they've tapped in their home equity line if they have that. They maybe have put some money on credit cards. And they have no other resources. It's either get a funding or possibly be evicted from their household.
Okay.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Schuller, then this is a loan, obviously. What kind of interest rates are then charged to the loan, and how do they compare with other conventional loans?
Mr. Schuller.
Madam Chair, in the majority of the cases, it's between about 2% and 4% a month. And this is, you know, a little bit high, but if they're taking into consideration between 18% and 22% of the fundings that we do, we receive no recovery on whatsoever. So that has to be kind of built into the business model. If you also want to kind of compare this to some of the new subprime credit cards that are out there, a quick example, First Premier just came out with a new credit card. geared around the new subprime market, which has an interest rate of 79.9%. If a person got a $1,000 on that credit card, it would the repayment on that $1,000 of making the minimum payment would be $17 million, and it would take the person 1,400 months to repay that.
And one last question,
Sounds like a bill.
This area is not regulated at all right now, so this practice can go on right now whether this bill passes or not. So this is basically to establish how to do it. Is that
Mr. Schuller?
That's correct, because we understand as a trade association, there may be players out there who do not do full notice and disclosure to consumers. That a consumer, when they're receiving a funding, may not know exactly what it is that they have. They may not have a 5-business-day ready rescission. We want to ensure that the consumers have a standard contract, and there's standard provisions in every single contract that's done here in the state of Minnesota. Right now, there is no standards in place.
And one last question, how do these interest rates compare, and maybe this is more for council, compare with the current usury requirements? I mean, is it exceeded? Is it within the cap? Or to prevent loan sharking, basically?
Senator Schneider, Mr. Schuller?
Well, no. You know, Madam Chair, I guess we do the math, but I don't think it's within. I don't think it's it exceeds the usury rate. The other aspect of this, of course, is that it's a non-recourse loan.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
And just to follow up on that, I have some other comments and questions as well, but I would also say to Senator Betzold that there is nothing in this bill that prevents these companies from charging any level of interest that they choose. And so common practice, you know, we don't really know. There's a host of different companies out there. All they have to do is disclose it, but they could charge anything. And by, in my opinion, by putting this language in statute, a very questionable practice today that's questionable with regard to its legality and legitimacy, we're now saying, well, okay, we're allowing this and we're not requiring any particular interest rate, and so the legislature must be intending to allow them to charge any rate they choose.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I would just point out that the bill does address the disclosures that must be made and to the consumer. So in 12-point bold type, total dollar amount to be funded, of course, obviously, an itemization of all the fees that are related to that contract, then the total dollar amount that would be repaid by the consumer in 6-month intervals for 36 months. So that's three years, and including all fees. And then the annual percentage rate return, et cetera. That disclosure has to be made. And I guess there are a number of companies doing this business and a person. And I think this is why we're also involving the attorney in a sense. We don't, you know, this is where we get that little diciness. But I think if a client came and said, well, there is these couple companies that I'm looking at for this loan, and the attorney, I think, would be able to say, well, you know, there are other companies out there, et cetera. I don't.
If I'm my address.
Can Mr. Schuller say something?
Mr. Schuller.
Madam Chair, it's very, happens on a regular basis that an attorney will get a copy of our contract and look at it and say, okay, I see what your fee is. I don't like this fee. I want this as a lower amount. And they will amend the contract. By putting it totally on every single contract that a Minnesota consumer has in front of them, their attorney can make changes to it. They can come to us and say, listen, Oasis, you have this rate, but if I go to ABC Company, they're charging me this rate. Can you guys match that or beat that? Our contracts are constantly changed. And so the only financial product that I'm really aware of that can be changed 3 times during the life of the product, it can be changed at the front end, it can be changed in the middle, and it can be changed in the back end. And that happens all the time.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Schuler, you made reference to a bank or a credit card company that was charging as high as 79%, but your rate that your field presents to a consumer is 2 to 4% per month. So am I right in computing this that on an annual basis it would be 24 to 48% per year?
Mr. Schuler?
Madam Chair, that's correct. But also we have to look into consideration if these are non-recourse. So if the case does not settle at all, in other words, it could go to court, it could settle short, and there is no recovery of any means, the consumer still has the money, and they owe us nothing. We walk away from the.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Lemon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schuler, let's take the circumstances away, and let's just look at this from a transaction that someone can get a loan. I'm not sure if it's in the consumer's interest to make it allowable to charge someone 24 to 48% for any reason, whatever the circumstance is. You know, we can talk of a 79% rate, but you said that it would take 1,400 months to pay it off, but 48% is, what, maybe half that or a little more than half of that? So let's just say half of that is 700 months to pay off. And that means it would take about 50 years to pay off on the payment schedule. Is that, am I computing this right?
Mr. Schuler.
Madam Chair, this fee structure is laid out in the payment schedule for the 36 months. It's clear on that. And it's really a not, wait, please. It's not an easy comparison to a conventional loan product in that if a person had a case pending and they went to Wells Fargo or they went to one of the banks and said, okay, I have this case pending. I'm expecting my attorney thinks I'm going to get this amount of money. I need money to pay my rent and to put lights on, keep my lights on. There's no tangible asset there for the bank to hold as collateral. And in most cases, I'd say probably 99.99%, that person's not going to receive any funds.
Mr. Schuler, the bill says, references that this is will be for litigants who are represented by an attorney. If somebody is not represented by an attorney, then are they not covered under this these statutes?
Madam Chair, we will not fund the individual. In order for the individual to receive funding, they have to be represented by counsel.
Madam Chair. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'd be interested to see one of the contracts, but I'm guessing that there's a concern that the attorney is kind of taking, this is another one of my concerns with this, is to a degree at least, the attorney is assuming some responsibility for making sure that this fee goes to you and gets paid out of the settlement, I'm assuming at the time of settlement, which is really, so having the attorney involved is for your protection more than anything. And I think that puts the attorney in a difficult position, not only for that reason, but for some other reasons that I'd like to just, when we get to that point, or maybe I can now, Madam Chair, just as a practical matter, explain one of the key problems that I have with this from, in addition to the consumer protection issue with charging usury interest and no limit in here. I mean, it could be 10% interest. And in the discussions that
were... Well, members, the usury issue, I mean, this bill came to us from Commerce. And I think that there's been, I'm assuming, some conversations in that committee on that.
Madam Chair, there was.
Now, I understand that some of us are not on that committee, and we have some concerns, and we like some questions answered. But I guess I don't know that we're going to be able to settle that question. And so if you've got concerns, I think you need to take it up with Senator Scheid, and maybe that could be a floor amendment or a floor conversation. But I don't know that. The contract issue is appropriate. I don't know that I want to spend a lot of time debating the interest rate issue with Senator Scheid and Mr. Schuler today.
Madam Chair, then I'll move to the second part of my concern that is probably more within the scope of this committee. as an attorney representing a person in this kind of a situation, you're not allowed ethically to advance costs to your client so that you don't have an interest in the outcome of the litigation. But it also means that in dealing with your client, there's nothing in this bill that says that this money has to be used for a particular person. And having represented lots of people in these situations, I empathize with the person that is having difficulties because of the injuries. But there are lots of other people who are continuing to work, and there are people, especially with the marketing tactics that are used by these businesses, who say, I would rather have my money now rather than waiting, for whatever their reason may be. Now, when it comes to trying to settle the case, as you go forward through this, you're not only having to deal with the attorney's fees that will come out of the settlement and the cost that will come out of the settlement, but now you have this big advance on recovery that's come out of the settlement as well. There's no motivation for somebody to attempt to resolve their case if they're not going to receive anything out of the settlement. And so you're now making everyone's job more difficult in trying to reach a settlement that makes sense all the way around for everybody, and I think really kind of changing the balance in a way that is going to increase litigation. And I don't think that's a good thing for anyone. I certainly think that it's good for people to fully be able to pursue their claims, but again, this is wide open in terms of who gets this money and what they might use it for. And I think that that's an unhealthy element to bring into the mix in trying to deal with these kinds of cases.
Well, Senator, I think what Senator Scheid is trying to do here is to say, I think it's balancing between having this industry be regulated or having it not be regulated. And so for the very reasons you've articulated, I think it's an issue for this committee to decide. Do we, for all the reasons that you've articulated, should we then just not regulate this industry? Or are the reasons you're articulating exactly why we should bring this industry under regulation? I find it unusual that an industry will make themselves, will come to government and say, please regulate us. I think our experience with this committee is everybody comes here and say, please, please, you know, don't put us under scrutiny. And so I think it's interesting for us to think about that. And I guess from a consumer protection standpoint, even if this is not a perfect bill, I'd rather err towards the side of some regulation so that we at least then can bring them back for a further conversation. Is there anybody here who would like to be heard in Senate File 2704? Please come up to the table. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, but I'm here this morning, Madam Chair, speaking on behalf of the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, which is a very broad coalition of 100-plus business trade associations and other individuals. We have a board. I'm on the board in addition to Tom Hesse of the Minnesota Chamber, Joan Archer, the licensed beverage, John Hausladen of the Truckers Association, and Mike Hickey of the National Federation of Independent Business, just to put the context in the group. And our board has voted and taken a position in opposition to Senate File 2704. And I'm not going to put any handouts out here, Madam Chair. We had some at Senate Commerce, but maybe just to focus on the question that I think is right before everybody right now, and I think it's really the issue is, which is some regulation better than none? And I think that's maybe the key point. And Madam Chair and committee members, what I'd like to suggest is that goes to what does this legislation do for consumers in Minnesota if these firms have been operating for whatever the limited number of years? And the main point is this, Madam Chair and committee members, is that I believe, and I'm not here to give a legal opinion, but I'm a lawyer, and I've talked to a number of lawyers who have read a 2004 Minnesota Court of Appeals decision, Johnson versus Wright, 682 Northwest 2nd, 671. And, Madam Chair, we can't do it here, but it's very important, and it is right on point to these transactions and these contracts, what's their status in Minnesota. And this is a court case that analyzes the common law doctrine of champerty and maintenance. And a contract is champertus and not enforceable if you advance or loan money to an individual and the payback of that money is dependent on the successful outcome of a lawsuit. Loan money to an individual and the payback is dependent on whether or not that lawsuit succeeds. Those contracts in Minnesota under the Johnson decision are not enforceable. And, Madam Chair, I think if you read the opinion again, it's very clear, I believe, on the face of it, because the opinion talks about the very transactions that are before the committee today. It cites other state Supreme Court decisions that have similarly ruled on this exact kind of transaction. And, Madam Chair, that's the core and at the essence of what's before the committee. Is something better than nothing? And, we believe that under this decision, there is a really good likelihood that whatever is out there is just simply not enforceable in Minnesota under common law. And a bill that provides registration and the other provisions that are in it may well legitimize what today is not legitimate in Minnesota. And that's a significant point. I think, Madam Chair, if you look at the ads, and I said it at Senator Scheid's committee, and I'm not an expert in this, but I've learned a lot about a brand new issue, I think, as a number of us have in the last, you know, 2-3 weeks, is that if you Google lawsuit loans and just start looking at the companies and look at how they operate, two things are very clear. And I think I've looked through a lot of the firms that pop up when you do that. It's couched as an industry that loans money. I think people understand loans, and so the ads say these are lawsuit loans. And there's rates that you pay in the lawsuit loans, and as Senator Olson and others have said, under this legislation, surely under today, there's no limit, literally no limit. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has put out materials that say there's a number of firms that charge 15% a month, so we're at 180% a year. So we're talking about numbers that are off the charts, unbelievable. And yes, is there a risk of not getting paid back? There is, but the point is this. The business model is wrapped in civil litigation. The marketing is to lawyers, consumers, but lawyers sign off. As Senator Olson said, what's the underwriting process? These firms contact the lawyers and ask for materials. I've read the ads that say, we contact your lawyer, we'll get a copy of the court documents, the medical records, and we're going to look at and evaluate whether or not we're going to advance money. So, Madam Chair, we think that business model is flawed. It raises serious, you know, ethical issues in terms of the lawyer-client privilege relationship. That the again, what it does in terms of this core model, but maybe lastly, this, Madam Chair and committee members, that Minnesota is one of 9 states out of 50. We're one of 9 states out of 50 that have a compulsory no-fault auto system. 41 do not. With the compulsory auto, we have a first-party medical coverage that we all are required to buy when we buy our policy. It's got $20,000 of medical. It's got $20,000 of wage loss. The kinds of transactions that I've heard described here of an average dollar amount of $1,700, maybe that is a particular problem in a state that doesn't have a no-fault auto with a first-party medical where consumers who are driving, and the majority of the clients, Madam Chair, in my conversations with the proponents, and I've had met with them, 75% of their business is auto accidents. 75%. So at least in this state, with a first-party medical and PIP coverage, those dollar amounts, the consumers have the protections. This is coverage. There's no copay. There's no deductible. There's no consumer sharing. You get it paid. It pays for household expenses. It pays for assistance if you can. And the kinds of cases that we have here, the overwhelming majority of injuries in Minnesota in car accidents is minor sprains and strains. People are not missing work. So there's not an out-of-work situation. So I firmly believe that we have a state and a system where this particular model, if it's got legitimacy, I don't think it's got a reason to be here, because we are a first-party, no-fault medical state that's got a coverage that covers the overwhelming majority of people. and it gives them the kinds of protections and when they're filing the lawsuit. So, Madam Chair, we think that we oppose the bill. We respect, obviously, this whole discussion here is something better than nothing, but we really don't think that that's our situation here. We think consumers have the protection under Johnson versus Wright, and those contracts are likely not enforceable in this state, and we respectfully disagree and would urge the committee to vote no on the bill.
Well, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson did reference the interplay here, the role of the attorney and the client, and there's still conversation to be had about that. And I know perhaps Mr. Carlson can actually say something. I know the Bar Association expressed to me some concern about that relationship. I don't think that the concern, well, I'll let them speak for themselves.
Mr. Carlson, and welcome to the committee.
The Bar Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I wish the photographer was here. I'm here on behalf of the Association for Justice, testifying with Senator Scheid on behalf of her bill against Mr. Johnson and the Insurance Federation. This is a unique day in Minnesota. Madam Chair and members, this is an imperfect situation, we understand, but we support Senator Scheid's efforts to put guardrails on this enterprise because the practice is ongoing right now. And we believe that we need registration, we need disclosure, we need to prevent referrals from providers to these funding companies, the things that are contained in this bill. It maybe isn't a perfect solution. But the bigger problem that we have right now is clients are coming to their counsel after the fact, after they have entered into these agreements without advice, and we think that having some involvement is appropriate. We're not sure that this is 100% the answer, but we know that there are problems out there when they come to you after they have entered into one of these loan agreements, which the lawyer right now has no knowledge of. I would also take some issue with Mr. Johnson relative to the case. You need to understand that in that case, the loan that was made specifically to the individual to go to the lawyer who could not afford the retainer fee, and it was specifically paid to fund the litigation. This bill actually prevents that from happening. None of the costs that are funded through these transactions, however good or bad they may be, do not go to the lawyer. They go to pay the personal expenses of the person getting the loan. And so I think there is a definite distinction between that case and this. I don't believe that it is on point. And I think that in that case, the court also said that a loan agreement with a third party where there's an expectation to get repaid, to pay, to let them survive during the litigation is valid in Minnesota. So I don't think that case is quite on point. We'd like to continue to work with the industry, who has been very open about wanting to regulate themselves, and Senator Scheid, and hopefully this will move forward and we can continue to do that. Thank you, Madam
Anyone
Chair.
Anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill? Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, what I see and what I hear indicate to me that we're really not in a position to pass out legislation that is still got a lot of work to do, and would be my suggestion that we look at some type of a task force or something that would work on this particular problem and ultimately come back to us with something that's more workable than what currently seems the plan.
Senator Scheid, what's your wish?
Oh, Madam Chair, I think that we will still continue to have conversations, particularly with the Bar Association and their concerns of that relationship with the attorney and the client, but I think it's important to begin to regulate. There are companies, a lot of companies, or a number of companies doing business with this that are not part of the association, that are not following best practices, and there's no disclosure, no disclosure requirement. I shouldn't say, I can't speak for those companies, but this would at least, and this would register the companies as well.
Well, members, I have some concern about letting this practice go unregulated, as unperfect or imperfect as we might think this bill is. I think it's important for us to take a look at to go down the path of trying to help the industry regulate itself. Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, is there anything in this Let me start over. Do these companies also lend money for people who are not in a lawsuit situation?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I don't know that.
Mr. Schuller?
Mr. Schuller?
Madam Chair, it's there has to be some sort of legal action, whereas it's not for home loans or whatever it is. I mean, it's. I guess I'm just a little confused as to how the question is worded.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schuller, my question was, does some other part of your company lend money for people who are not in a legal problem situation? I mean, could somebody go to your company and just get a loan because they're in arrears
Mr. Schuller.
And aren't being sued?
Madam Chair, no.
All right, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 2704 be recommended to pass.
Discussions on that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no.
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 Motion prevails.
Division.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
All those in favor, please raise your hands. All those opposed, please raise your hand. Well, I guess the chair has a hard hearing today. The motion does not prevail on a
Thank
tie
you.
Vote.
Sorry about that.
Senator Pappas, thank you for waiting. Okay. You keep this. You keep that.
Madam Chair, thank you for fitting me into your schedule. I know how hard you all have been working. Senate File 3145. Madam Chair, first of all, I have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment.
Such a simple bill.
Senator Pappas, I just want to warn you that you have a one-sentence bill, and it's a two-page author's amendment. And so if Senator Betzel gets excited, don't take offense. Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill into shape the author would like it to be in. Discussions on that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 3145 amends the definition of mixture in Minnesota statutes, and the definition had to be amended four times, Senator Betzel. That's why it's so long. But it's the same definition. It will require law enforcement to determine the purity of a mixture that contains a controlled substance residue before weighing the controlled substance for purposes of determining the level of offense. Without this change in the law, law enforcement may make charging decisions based on the entire weight of the mixture that contains a controlled substance residue, even if the drug residue is only a small fraction of the mixture. Madam Chair, I have with me Professor Ted Samsel Jones. He's a professor at William Mitchell, and he has an interest in this case. It went before the courts, and he's going to give us a very short explanation of why we're here today.
Professor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd encourage you today to pass this legislation. The goal of it is to overrule or limit the effect of the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision last fall in State versus Peck. Peck ruled that bong water counts as a mixture for the purposes of Chapter 152, and thus that the weight of bong water should be added to the weight of drugs found in a defendant's possession. I've been working for the last several months with representatives from the County Attorneys Association and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehensions to work on a legislative fix to that case, and I believe we have reached an appropriate and reasonable solution. The problem with Peck is that it upsets the statutory scheme of graded punishments for controlled substances offenses in Minnesota. If you consider a quick hypothetical to see what the problem is, imagine two people who both purchase a small amount of marijuana for personal use. They both go home and smoke it. One uses an ordinary pipe without any filtration system, and the other one uses a bong or water pipe, which uses maybe a few ounces of water as a filter for the smoke. Under the Supreme Court's decision in Peck, the person who uses the bong is punished far more severely than the person who doesn't. In the case of marijuana, the person who uses a bong would be guilty of a felony rather than the small amount provision in the statute. And in the case of methamphetamine, where users sometimes also use water pipes or filtration systems, what PEC means is that any small-time user who happens to use a water pipe is guilty of a first-degree controlled substances offense, which has a mandatory sentence of 30 years in this state and a presumptive sentence of 7 years. So the goal of the bill is to fix the problem that PEC created and get the statute back into a state where people are punished in proportion to the gravity of their offense.
So we're not charging users for being dealers simply because of the quantity of dirty water that's involved.
Questions for Senator Pappas or the professor? Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 3145 as amended be recommended to pass. Question: any discussions of that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Thank you very much, Madam
motion
Chair.
Motion prevails. Senator Betzel and then Senator Scheid, we're going to come back to your bill.
Which bill?
The DNA bill.
Do bong water already?
Yes.
I missed it?
Gosh. They got samples on the end of the table.
Senator Betzel, Senate File 2354.
Madam Chair, Senate File 2354 deals with a provision in the Data Practices Act. As those of us who have been working on this issue over the years understand, there's a provision in the Data Practices Act presumes that public information is generally public unless there's an exception. It also provides remedies for citizens and other organizations that if they seek information that they should be entitled to get and they're denied it, the remedy is to go to court, which really is not much of a remedy because when you consider the time and the expense of going to court to get something that should be public anyway, it's not really worth it to most people to do it, but that's been the law. What this bill does is set up a process by which a party who feels that they're being denied information can go not to court but to an administrative hearing officer and have a rather quick and far less expensive process to get the information. As you go through the first engrossment, I'll call your attention on Section 3. That's really where most of the information has. It describes on line 311 that the complaint must be filed within 2 years of the occurrence. There's a filing fee on page 3.18. The complainant who seeks the information must pay a filing fee of $1,000. At the bottom of page 3, starting at line 3.33, the chief administrative law judge assigns an administrative law judge to review the complaint. Within 20 days, they have to determine whether there's any merit to it. At the top of page 4, starting on line 4.3, if there's not sufficient facts to support a violation of the law, then the complaint must be dismissed. If there are sufficient facts to support a violation of the law, then on page 4.7, 4.8, then a hearing would be scheduled. 4.11, notice must be provided of the hearing. If the case is dismissed, starting on page 4.14, then the parties can seek reconsideration of that dismissal. If the complaint is going to go forward, line 4.25, the hearing will be held within 30 business days, although you can delay that for good cause for 10 business days. The hearing must be open to the public. And then the remedies at the top of starting at 5.5, the judge can dismiss the complaint, file that there's a violation of the chapter. They can impose a civil penalty against the respondent, which is usually a government agency, of about $300, or issue an order compelling compliance with the law, and even refer the complaint for prosecution if that is appropriate. The bill also provides, and if you go to the bottom of page 5.35, there's a presumption that a person who prevails, a presumption that the person is entitled to reasonable attorney's fees not to exceed $5,000. Again, that's only a presumption. The award may be denied if the judge determines the violation was merely technical or there's really uncertainty about the law. The office shall refund the filing fee, the $1,000 filing fee, less $50 plus the office's cost to be in conducting the matter, not to exceed $1,000. Now, if somebody files a frivolous complaint, then the judge can order that complainant, the person who filed the frivolous complaint, can pay the respondent's reasonable attorney's fees not to exceed $5,000. So that, Madam Chair, is the bill. There's an A3 amendment, which is really more of a technical amendment, although the on lines 1.9 to 115, that more clarifies how the administrative law judge is to be handling closed hearings when there's protective and secret information and how to handle that. Otherwise, most of the A3 amendment, as I say, is just more technical cleanup language. And so I'll offer the A3 amendment to the bill.
And the amendment is being passed to us and is
getting passed
out.
Okay. Yeah.
Members, questions to Senator Betzel on the A3 amendment? Senator Betzel has moved the A3 amendment. Discussions on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Any questions to Senator Betzel on the bill?
And Madam Chair, I know there are people here to testify on it, so.
Ms. Nairn?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sandy Nairn. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Just as quick background, this bill was actually instigated by a number of legislators who approached the Newspaper Association and asked for assistance in coming up with a better enforcement mechanism for violations of the Data Practices Act. They were hearing from constituents who had been asking for copies of public data and were being denied this and feeling that they had no recourse other than to go to court, which was too expensive for them. So we worked on, we brainstormed for a while to try and come up with an idea on how to do this, and we decided to use as a template legislation that was passed by this legislature in 2004. Chief author was Senator Higgins, so she may recognize some of this language in this bill. The provision that was passed in 2004 set up an administrative process for violations of election law complaints. The legislature chose at that time to send all of those to the Office of Administrative Hearings instead of to the county attorney's office and through the court system, decided it would be faster and cheaper for all the parties to resolve the disputes that way. So we came up with the idea to use that as a template for violations of the Data Practices Act when people are asking for copies of public data. This language is very similar and based on that. The A3 amendment that Senator Betzel put on the bill reflects the requests of a number of different groups for technical amendments to this bill. Hennepin County Attorney's Office, Office of Administrative Hearings, Education Minnesota. We think all the parties that we have discussed this bill with, from townships to cities to counties to school districts to county attorney's offices to Department of Administration to some private citizens who are concerned, we think we have addressed everybody's concern, and as far as we know through the five committees this bill has already been through on both the House and Senate, no one has testified in opposition. I think there are a couple individuals who would like this bill to go farther than it does, and we don't disagree with them, but during a short session we had to try and not parade to 10 committees instead of the 8 or so that we're already going to have to go to. So this bill is a good beginning, and we hope that the legislature will expand on it in future years if they find it to be successful. I think you just were handed out a number of editorials and articles from different newspapers around the state in favor of this bill.
Anybody would like to be heard on Senate File 2354? I have Ms. Neumeister's name on here. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I have not been one of the stakeholders that have been involved in developing this piece of legislation before the legislative session began. I was aware that this bill, something like this, was happening. I did see a draft. And as the bill was introduced, I thought it was a very promising bill. It still is the premise of the bill. But what it does in its subtleties of language becomes not friendly to citizens who are, again, trying to have data practices laws comply for where they can get public information, which is an important thing, but also this applies, on the other hand, for individuals who want to get access to their own private data and to make public entities comply with other individual rights in the Data Practices Act. I'm going to point out to you some of the parts of the bill that I think that need to be addressed in before it leaves either this committee or it becomes law. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want you to think the following. This is government. I was trained as an interpreter for the deaf, so I'm very much aware of sign language. This is the government. G, this is the citizen. For the last 30 years, because as Senator Betzelt says, you have to sue in court to make compliance with the Data Practices Act. It's always been like this. Historically,
you know,
this...
No, I need you to get to the bill. Okay. We have lots of things we've got to get done.
...has been trying to move this up. And what's happening, it's not moving farther enough. And I think what it is, it needs to go a little bit further. The parts of the bill that are as follows. On page 3, lines 3.9 and 3.10, they exclude almost possibly up to 750,000 to 1 million people in the state of Minnesota to have access to this easier remedy, particularly for parents who want to be able to get access to their student records, for that they parents can advocate for their students. Secondly, there are a number of students who are adults who are not be able to get to use this as a remedy when school districts or colleges say we're not going to give the data to you. One of the major problems has been, or complaints have been, parents, students who want to get access to their student records.
Oh, I see. There it is.
There are opinions on it. There's a well-known case called the Baldwin case in Minnesota that dealt with that issue. I don't want to describe that situation, but I can. But I think that needs to be eliminated. Now, one of the discussions and the points that have been made about this, and this was a deal that was cut with the School Boards Association, that, you know, it may violate FERPA or whatever. OAH historically has dealt with issues dealing with educational data, whether it be under when there's contesting accuracy and and completeness of that data under current law of Chapter 13, or in some of the Office of Administrative Hearings when they're dealing with the IEP process. So data has always been an issue. I would encourage this to be taken out. Secondly, in some of the subtleties of the language, as the bill has been described, they're trying to base it somewhat, rather than go to court, you know, this was one option. They tried to modify it on the 1308 compliance language. There are little subtleties in here, though, that make it harder for citizens. My perspective of how government attorneys will use things. On page 6, lines 2 and 3, merely technical or that there is genuine uncertainty about the meaning of the governing law. In the 1308 provision, when you're going to court, they don't have that item in there. On page 614, on line 14, 15, under 1308, when you compel for compliance in 1308, when you read that, they do have frivolous, which is no problem, but or brought for the purposes of harassment. Now, those are little things that can have an impact on citizens. On this particular one, for example, let's say a person is trying to get information, either about themselves or to comply, to get an agency to comply with the Tennyson warning or whatever it might be. They may call maybe 4, 5, 6 times. The government can just throw out, hey, it's for harassment. Again, the citizen is at, I think, at a different kind of stand in order to counter that charge. And if the AALJ says, hey, yeah, I agree with your harassment, which is an extra thing different than 1308, and if they might, you know, they might be paying for the whole thing of what the government, you know, on the government side. So, Madam Chair, in summary, I contend there are some items in here that need to be taken out or addressed and questions asked, and to make it, I think, more citizen-driven, not necessarily media-driven, with, from my point of view, deals done with the government entities and not at the behest of for citizens. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Mr. Gimberlin?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Don Gimberling. I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. The coalition is a group of people, citizens, librarians, attorneys, journalists, former state employees, who are concerned about issues of government information. Our board has actually taken a position on this bill, and what I'm going to describe to you is the board's position. First, let me thank Senator Betzold for trying one more time to find a better way to enforce the Data Practices Act. I think this is at least his third attempt, and the fifth or sixth attempt in the history of the Act. But I want to emphasize a couple of things. First, the concerns that the Coalition on Government Information has have been addressed to the media folks, to the media lobbyists, and our concerns are not addressed by what's in the bill. Okay? What we're developing in this bill is kind of like a strange split between those people who are normally on the same side, and that split is along the lines of, are we doing stuff for citizens who are representatives of the media, and what are we doing for citizens who are just citizens, okay, like me and a bunch of other people in Minnesota, a couple of million of them. And there are real subtle things in that bill, in this bill, that you have to kind of pull out to understand those differences. And I've identified some of those to Senator Betzold. I don't intend to go through that level of detail. But keep in mind, there is this strange split, and I'll give you a couple of illustrations. The one that Richard identified, Mr. Neumeister identified, the bill acquired an amendment after I saw it originally that excludes from this new remedy the ability of citizens who have disputes about educational data to use the new remedy. Now, I understand in the politics of lobbying why that amendment is there. I just think it's horrible policy. One of the things that I dealt with repeatedly when I worked for the state of Minnesota was that school districts produce lots of disputes about data issues. Okay? And the strange thing about school districts is they're subject to two different laws on educational records.
Mr. Gimberlin, can you just – I think we understand the context. So can you just quickly go through your concerns with the bill?
Okay.
I would personally appreciate it.
I understand.
Thank you.
I really strongly urge you to take that section out of the bill because it just doesn't make good sense. Second issue, the bill says you can bring – you can use the new remedy for violations of this chapter, meaning the statute. This chapter also has rules that implement the chapter that were adopted 30 years ago and are still in effect. But under the language of the bill, you can't bring a dispute arising out of the rules through the new process. The way to fix that is just add after the word chapter or rules promulgated thereunder. Lastly, without going into detail, there are parts of this bill that will still offer the government opportunities to use time and tactical delays to cut away at what Senator Betzold is trying to accomplish, okay? And there are parts of the bill that will make it more difficult for citizens, just plain folks, and media citizens to use the bill effectively. So take a close look at it. As I said, it's a good idea. One more thing I need to add before I shut up. This bill keeps being portrayed as a bill that only deals with disputes about access to public data, and the bill doesn't do that. It does that, but it says you can use the new remedy for any dispute arising out of this chapter. And there are lots of disputes that citizens have, non-media citizens, that have nothing to do with access to public data. There are other kinds of data disputes. For example, failure of a government agency to give the notices required by the Data Practices Act. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Gimberling or Ms. Nairn, Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzold, Mr. Gimberling suggested some alterations to your bill. Have you had any discussion with Mr. Gimberling, and what is your opinion of doing that?
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I think the issue that he's, the main issue he's referring to, page 3, line 9, it says an action may not be filed involving a request for educational data classified under 13.32. Again, I wasn't part of the initial discussions that led to the drafting of the bill. However, in the early stages of this bill, however, it's my understanding that there were concerns from the education community about the federal law requirements and so forth. And it's an important issue, but again, given the constraints and the time and everything that we've got, it frankly was not a fight that I wanted to take on at this stage. I wanted to just try to see if we could get the rest of the framework in and leave that issue for another day.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzold, if this is a good bill in terms of the remedy, which it seems like it is, in making it streamlining the access for people to contest denials of records, wouldn't you think that it would be possible that in the future that there might be some better reception to perhaps becoming a part of this process once it's in place and it's working? I guess that's just my thought. So, and then I have a second question as well. I'm just wondering, we did get one letter from someone with a concern about the $1,000 filing fee. And I'm just wondering where that what that would compare with regard to a court filing fee. I'm not sure off the top of my head now where we're at with that filing fee cost and where that number came from.
I'm not sure where the number came from, but the filing fee, I mean, most of these could probably be handled pro se, by the individuals. You can't go into district court and act pro se. I mean, so the filing fee may be a difference, but, you know, as a practical matter, you'd almost have to hire an attorney, which, you know, there are significant costs after that, but I'll defer to Ms. Nairn on the $1,000 part.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Nairn.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the filing fee was arrived at as a suggestion from the Office of Administrative Hearings because we had to make this bill fiscally neutral. We could not be asking for general fund money in order to run this program, similar to what we did with the election bill back in 2004. So they had suggested this fee as an upfront fee in order to pay the potential hearing costs. A complainant who prevails will get back all of that fee minus $50, so they will only be out $50 if they prevail in the action, and then the government body will pay the Office of Administrative Hearings hearing costs. We've also put in a provision that lets a litigant get a bond to guarantee the $1,000 filing fee, which can be obtained, I understand, for $75. So we did put that option in. And, of course, we had to put the fee in to make it fiscally neutral. As Senator Betzold says, we think the biggest advantage of going to this process versus court will be that one can do it without a lawyer. And that is usually the biggest cost in going to court at this time.
Senator Betzold, on line 3.28, or Ms. Nairn, it says proceedings under this section must be dismissed if a request for an opinion from the commissioner was accepted on the matter. Is it just merely accepted, or is it accepted and pending? Ms. Nairn?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Where were you looking?
Line 3.27 to line 3.28, unless the amendment took this out.
The amendment did not change this, Madam Chair.
Okay. Council just wanted to make sure that we're clarifying. Is that was accepted by the commissioner?
Yes. Madam Chair, yes. I think that's the language.
Is it accepted and pending?
Well, Madam Chair, if it's just pending, you don't know what the commissioner is going to rule.
Right.
So, this says it has to be dismissed. I don't see why you would want to dismiss something that it might be pending before the commissioner. If the commissioner has actually issued an opinion that's on point, I think that that may say why do we have this complaint when we've got a commissioner's opinion.
This language was put in by the Department of Administration. Let me have them explain it to you.
Chair and members, I'm Lori Barkopensky, the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division. What the language is intended to do is, if there is already a pending action at the Department of Administration, that the OAH will hold off, they will dismiss anything, wait for the commissioner to issue a decision, and then someone will have the ability to then refile.
Okay. So this language works?
This language works.
Ms. Barkopensky.
Say something.
Madam Chair and members, yes.
Okay.
All right. As long as that's the understanding that someone will have the ability to refile once the commissioner is finished.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, for another $1,000?
I believe they get their fees.
They get refunded.
It gets refunded. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Dr. Ann Frisch. I'm Professor Emerita, University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh.
You came all this way to testify on this bill?
No, I'm a new resident of Minnesota. I live in White Bear Lake. When I read the editorial about this bill, I was very astonished. I've been an activist on public records issues for 20 years. And I essentially work in coffee shops, help people draft public records requests. And I'll tell you about one of them that I did. Michigan Department of Agriculture told a young couple who lived in a little woods that they had to bulldoze their property because there was a pest on that property that was causing damage to commercial growers. I helped her write a public records request. There was no such data. They had been given the choice of bulldozing the property themselves.
Professor, I'm really grateful that you're here
to
give us your thoughts.
Okay, I'm just
telling you. That's a Michigan case. So can you just talk to us about the bill and Minnesota?
They would not have had $1,000 to file to protect their property. I am absolutely astonished that this is – everybody is so comfortable with this filing fee. This – I would not bother to file a request knowing that the government could – hold it up for to appeal, and then I would have to come up with $1,000. It's not that I wouldn't get $950 back. It's that I don't have $1,000 to help people be involved in the operations of government. In fact, I don't want to pay $50 every time I help somebody with a records request. So this would end my citizen advocacy using public records.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor, we read your letter, and we asked a question because of your letter. My understanding is, in order to do something to help citizens get records right now, because of our budget, we can't do something that's going to add additional cost to the budget, so we're trying to make this a revenue-neutral proposition. And so the solution that's been proposed is one where you could, from my understanding, you could spend $75 and get a bond. Of course, then you'd lose that $75 if you're purchasing a bond, I assume. Or I suppose another alternative might be that you just pay something more similar to a court filing fee, which is, I was told, $310, which would be your option without this bill. That's the option. You'd have to challenge this without the bill, I think. And then you wouldn't probably get that money back, and maybe that would be more revenue neutral, or maybe that would be another alternative. But we're trying to find the best alternative to be as fair without and find a way to pay for this. So I guess that
Senator Betzel.
Yeah, Madam Chair, another option. Again, this does not preclude you from going to court. If you went to court, you could file an informal pauperis proceeding and be able to not have to pay anything. But you know, I don't think we have informal pauperis proceedings with the Office of Administrative Hearings. So this does not preclude going to court.
Professor, I would love to have you come back the next time the chair has a bill to repeal all the judiciary fees that we've imposed. And we do have a bill like that. And I am absolutely in agreement with you that when the fees get so high that it bars people from access to the system that we have set up to protect them, there's something wrong about that. So thank you for your comments. Yeah. Anyone else who would like to be heard in Senate File 2354? All right. Senator Betzel, I believe we're trying to accommodate the
the K-12 Education Appropriations Committee and their work. Most of that work is ongoing, I understand, but they have in there contemplated a very small data provision. To their credit, they understood that the policy committees were going to be done with our work, and they wanted to bring that to our attention. Instead of having the entire bill here, we took the very limited data provision that's in there. I understand from Ms. Pontius that it is a good thing that they notified us about it because it had to be rewritten. And so, members, we have posted the bill. We even specifically indicated to the public that Senator Stumpf will not be here, but we refer them to the section of that bill that is going to be before the committee today. And the way that I think that it's appropriate for us as a committee to act is that Senator Betzel has been willing to allow his bill to be the potential vehicle for that language. If we approve it and we end up putting it on Senator Betzel's bill, Senator Betzel will work with Senator Stumpf on how to move that language appropriately into Senator Stumpf's bill. But it was important that they notify us about that provision so that our committee can have an opportunity to speak on it. So we have an amendment to Senator Betzel's bill that is this language that we now will go through. I believe there are two individuals from the Department of Education. This is, I believe, is a department provision. So there are two members from the department who are here who will speak briefly, or one of them will speak briefly to this language. Ms. Barnridge and Mr. Malik, which one of you have you seen the amendment?
Madam Mr. Chair, Malik? Yes, I have.
Okay. So, can you just quickly? I think all the members have. Can you quickly walk us through this and just give us a reason why we need this language?
Madam Chair, members,
could we get an amendment down here too?
Yep.
This amendment would allow us to collect E-12 student data to be shared both with the Board of Teaching and the Board of School Administrators from the department for their ongoing program approval process. It will not contain E-12 student identification information, the teacher and principal data regarding licensure programs completed would be shared as necessary to align performance to preparation programs. And it will be used primarily by higher education to identify and address weaknesses in their preparation programs, both for teachers and principals.
Okay. Ms. Barnridge, did you need to speak on this? No. All right. Is there anybody who would like to speak on the A4 amendment? I mean, as I said, we have posted, so people have noticed that we're going to be discussing this section.
And again, Madam Chair, the point needs to be made. There's a kind of a data provision like this in the E-12 budget bill. I think I saw a version of it, and I think this handles it better because we didn't want to pull the whole budget bill into this committee. So if it's added to this bill, my bill still has to go to the Finance Committee, and we can kind of sort it out there. So I'll move the A4 amendment.
Senator Betzel's motion, discussions on the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Betzel, you want to move your bill?
Madam Chair, if there's no one else wants to be heard, I'll move that Senate File 2354 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Discussions on the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay. All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Scheid. Members, we're going to go back to pick up Senator Scheid's DNA bill, which we laid on the table last night at Senator Ortman's request. It is my understanding that the Hennepin County Attorney's Office have been working with Senator Scheid and Mr. Backus to try to respond to some of the questions and concerns that were raised yesterday. I know for a fact that after we adjourned, they worked very hard on that, and I want to thank Mr. Backus as well as Mr. Brown and Ms. Redding for working so hard to be responsive to the committee's concerns. So, members, there is an amendment.
This is a committee members meant to show what we do.
I see. All right. So, members, Mr. Backus did a lot of work last night. He has provided us with a committee engrossment of what we did yesterday, and that is in the S3116CE1 document that's in front of you. And then the A3 amendment contains the language that Mr. Brown and Mr. Redding, along with Mr. Backus, have been worked out to try to address our concerns. And we'll get the language. Can you guys get the document to the author first?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And then, Mr. Brown, can you walk us through the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Hang on a second. Mr. Backus, the A3 amendment is drafted to the committee engrossment. So, Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, this is essentially a delete-all, because by the time we got done adding pieces here and there, it became difficult to read. So much of the language is the same as yesterday, but as I walk you through it, what we really try to do is make it so it's as simple as possible to read. Otherwise, that becomes difficult. Picking up on the committee's concerns and taking their suggestions, we believe we've created a process that provides for more notice up front and more opportunity for the offender to be heard. What you will see in paragraph A is a motion by the prosecuting attorney for an order to show cause, which is something fairly well recognized in the law. It's the way we bring somebody into court and ask them to show why we shouldn't do something. And it has the exact same provisions for identifying who those people are. If you go to paragraph B, it directs the offender to show, and it provides that this has to be on paragraph B, it directs the offender to appear before the court within 30 days after they've been served, and then provides that the prosecutor shall serve that order in the same manner as a civil summons. And that's typically by a letter where we get an acknowledgement of receipt or personal service upon them. The offender can avoid appearing in court. That is, if they get one of these letters, they can avoid appearing in court by voluntarily providing the sample. So if they get this letter and say, I'll give the sample, and we would envision a situation where that order to show cause would also give a time and place where they would be able to give that voluntary sample. In paragraph C, we have what happens if the offender appears. And if the offender comes into court, and they must be given an opportunity to be heard, then the court may, and this is picking up on a suggestion from the committee that the language to the court be made discretionary, not mandatory. The court may issue an order directing the offender to provide the sample. And obviously, once the court has the person in front of the court, then the court can decide how they want to accomplish the giving of that sample, where they want them direct them to go to do that. So paragraph D tells us what happens if the offender doesn't respond to that order to show cause. So now they've actually been given civil service of that order, and they have either failed to provide the sample voluntarily, gone into the place where they could, or not shown up in court within the 30 days. And at that point, that's when the court can issue the order that requires them to give the sample within 30 days at a specific place, includes the address and the location of that place, or then authorizes law enforcement to go out and bring them back before the court, because now they've been served, personally served, and they did not show up in court, or they've been given civil service, and it allows them to bring them before the court, and now you have to explain why you shouldn't follow that order. So this is a process where we have more notice up front before we're doing anything, and multiple opportunities, even once the order is drafted. If you look at line 1.32, there's still an opportunity once law enforcement goes out to tell them that the court has issued that order, there's still an opportunity for them to comply without having to be brought before the court.
Madam Chair. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you very much, Mr. Brown and Senator Scheid, for your work on this. I really appreciate the time you took to try to address some of the concerns this committee had. And I would also say that regarding the constitutional issue that we were a bit unsure about yesterday, that it seems to me that although you've assured us that you believe that this is constitutional, if for some reason a person wanted to challenge that, they would now, under the process you have, be in front of the court where they could make that argument, and then it would be appropriately for the court to make that decision.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that is correct. This explicitly gives them the opportunity to be heard. Now, typically when somebody's brought before a court, they have that as a matter of right. But this really addressed the committee's concern, and I think Mr. Redding for making that explicit in here, that when they are before the court, they do have an opportunity to be heard. So thank you for that.
Any further discussions?
Senator
Foley.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Brown, looking at this, and that one of the things I didn't think you addressed dealt with data files that would indicate that a person was arrested and a DNA test was made, and then she was found not guilty. And how does that person remove that from the file?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, in the instance where, first of all, nobody is ordered to provide DNA under this chapter where they've been acquitted. This chapter only applies when somebody has been convicted of a felony or was initially charged with a felony and was convicted of a lesser crime arising out of that. So this chapter, the one we're dealing with here, only applies to samples taken after somebody has been convicted. I think the provision you're thinking about perhaps is times where during a court case we ask somebody to provide a sample as an evidentiary tool and that they are acquitted of that. There are separate expungement procedures for that, and this bill does not attempt to do that. So this is not that situation that I think you're talking about, Senator.
Senator Scheid moves the 8-3 amendment. Senator Scheid, are you comfortable?
Madam Chair, yes. And Mr. Redding, Mr. Brown, Mr. Backus, thank you for all your hard work in doing this. And I think it made a good bill with a very good premise much better, and I appreciate the work of the committee. I'd like to move. I'm speaking on behalf of my amendment, Madam Chair.
So Senator Scheid moves the 8-3 amendment. Discussions on that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Scheid moves the Senate file 3116 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any discussions on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for the committee's patience.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
I can go across back to that.
Something else, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your exercise.
That was good work.
Hey, we could be done here at a reasonable time.
Senator Moy, you have several bills. Which would you like to take first?
Madam Chair, members, let's take Senate File 3517 first.
3517? 25. Madam Chair, 2517?
Yep, 2517.
Just
Madam Chair, members, Senate File 2517 is a
pretty short bill. This bill just merely adds audio or video files in electronic format to the list of documents that currently are being provided. There is a A1 amendment to that I'd like to offer as an author's amendment to just continue that adds yet another small piece to the bill. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment.
Senator Moy moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, members, I take questions on the bill.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, on the A1 amendment, CD-ROM and DVD-ROM really should be all caps. They aren't. I mean, they are. They mean things, and they're.
Senator Moy, are you comfortable with an amendment that would capitalize CD-ROM and DVD-ROM?
I will move that, Madam Chair.
Senator Moy moves that on line 1.2, CD-ROM, and on line 1.3, DVD-ROM be capitalized. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Senator Moy. Just one question. Do we run afoul of any licensing agreements when we have to provide the software to the public defender in a format that they don't already have? And as I say, it isn't, you know, if the public defender paid or the county attorneys paid for the program, they can't necessarily just give that program, the software, over to somebody else unless they all also pay for that. I'm just wondering if we have some problem there.
Senator Moy?
Senator Betzel, I believe that there is a good answer for that, and my witness will answer that question.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Robert Sikora. I'm a lawyer with the State Board of Public Defense. It's not the intent of the bill and shouldn't be the intention of the legislature to require any violation of federal copyright law, and even if you tried, that would be preempted by those federal laws. Our purpose is, if you recall, kind of the oldest example is you get a file and it ends in PDF and you can't open it until you get the free viewer. Well, that's the simplest and oldest example. There are many newer examples with dashboard video and in-store video surveillance for loss prevention for retailers. There are many, many formats. So this language updates the statute to recognize that there are those many formats, and for those formats, there are free viewers that are obtainable if you paw around on the internet to find them. We just don't want to invest state staff time pawing around on the internet when the prosecutor's already done that and found the free viewer.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, and just another clarification, don't the rules of criminal procedure already provide that we have to have electronic disclosure if the method is available to both parties?
Yeah, Rule
Mr.
9.
Point,
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, Rule 9.03, Subdivision 10 says if the method is available to both parties. So this is consistent with the rule because should someone attempt to disclose a document without the viewer, it isn't available.
Thank you.
Senator Betzel?
Thank you.
Any other questions or further discussion?
I'm good.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on this bill?
Madam Chair, if there's no more discussions, I'd like to move that Senate File 2517, as amended, be recommended to pass.
And be referred to the floor?
Yes.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, I'd like to take up Senate File 1126. Members, Senate File 1126 is a bill that we've already passed out of this committee, and it went to the Senate floor. You may recall we had a lot of conversations on this bill. It is the used deeds bill that we looked at last session. There were some uncertainty in the other body about this language, and so we when we passed it and went to the floor, I did an amendment of this language to the tax bill. And because there were uncertainty in the other body, they needed some time to kind of think this through. We didn't include it in the tax bill last year. This year is our understanding that there's some the concerns have been laid to rest. And so we're coming back to the committee. I didn't put this on the agenda when we dealt with all the bills that were kicked back to us at the beginning of the legislative session, because I wanted to make sure that we weren't wasting committee time. Now that we've been given the green light that things are kind of kosher, we wanted to bring it back and to then send the bill back to the floor. Between the time when this committee acted on this bill and we sent it to the floor, and then we amended to the tax bill, a number of different stakeholders have had an opportunity to look at the bill. And so some minor, with feedback from the Bar Association, from practitioners, from people who are involved in this area, there are some minor technical verbiage changes that have been made to the language, so it's not exactly as it was when it left us. And there are two provisions that have been added to the bill that Mr. Nord is here to talk to us about that, again, came from, I believe, the Bar Association to just better clarify the bill. So I would like him to speak to those two provisions. Otherwise, except for minor technical verbiage changes, the bill is exactly as it left us.
Good morning, Mr. Nord. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jason Nord. I work at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The changes, Senator Moy is correct that the vast majority of the changes to this bill have mainly been changes in language to improve the way that different things are stated and to lay people's concerns to rest. The two new sections are Section 7. This was requested over the interim by the Bar Association. Their philosophy was that we're creating a lot of new opportunities to acquire tax forfeited lands, and they wanted to make sure that all the conditions surrounding those means are can be proven in the real estate records. So Section 7 is meant to identify that the real estate records are prima facie evidence that the conditions in those different provisions have been met to increase your reliability on the real estate records for the validity of the deeds. Also, Section 13 was added by the House author kind of at the behest of the Bar Association as well. This provision ensures that when local government decides to change the use.
Mr. Nord, could I interrupt you for a minute? We have an A5 amendment here, and I'm wondering if you're speaking to the amendment or to the bill.
Madam Chair, members, I apologize. The A5 amendment is a delete everything amendment, so refer to the A5 amendment.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Madam
yes.
Chair. Senator Higgins.
We also have the A10-2379 amendment.
A5 replaces it.
A5 replaces it. Okay.
A5 is the operating document.
Thank
you. Timing told me that they wanted it.
Okay, sorry.
Mr. Nord.
Sure. The A5 amendment, I've explained Section 7. The new Section 13 was added, again, by the House author at the behest of the Bar Association. What that does is it says that if a local government is going to change the use of a parcel that it has acquired via a use deed, it must first notify the surrounding parcels and give them notification and hold a hearing so that they can provide input on any changes in use that might occur. Just to note quickly, the old Section 12 was something that was no longer needed due to the changes from last year. So Section 12 of the second engrossment from last year has also been removed as it was no longer necessary. But otherwise, again, mainly just kind of comfort language and minor changes.
So, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A5 amendment.
Madam Senator Moy has moved the A5 amendment. Are there any questions or is there any discussion on that motion? Senator Moy, I have one question for your witness on Section 13 regarding the notice and the public hearing for use change. Is that a provision that makes a substantive change in law? And if so, is that something that local governments have expressed any opinion about one way or the other?
Madam Chair, It is an additional notice, so it is something that is new. I have not heard any significant concern about that from any of the interested parties. It's meant to be, I believe, an extra redundancy just to make sure that neighbors who've become used to the use of a UC parcel have an ability to be aware of any changes to that use.
Okay. Thank you. On Senator Moy's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, if there is no further discussion, I'd like to move that Senate File 1126, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I'd like to take up Senate File 2437. Members, this is a procedural move on our part. As you know, earlier in the session, we spent a day or half a day looking at domestic abuse bills, and we have packaged an omnibus bill. The other body has notified us that they prefer a different bill to be the, what do you call it?
Vehicle.
The vehicle, yes, the vehicle. So to accommodate the other body, we are creating the same omnibus bill, but just in a different vehicle. So we're taking the content of our vehicle bill and we're putting it into Senate File 2437. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
On that amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 2437, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair and members.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Moy, if we have other bills that we would like to be included in this omnibus bill now, would it be appropriate to put them in on the floor or...
Are they bills that this committee dealt with?
I don't have any in mind, but I'm just asking in case.
Oh, I see. In terms of bills relating to domestic abuse that we may have sent out on its own and didn't have a chance to put it, I would be open to conversation about that.
Okay, thanks.
Members, I want to thank you all for... Well, it's been a really long 3 weeks, and I want to thank you all so much for your great work on behalf of the members of the Senate. I want to especially thank all the staff, from my staff, Peter and Eric and James. And in particular, I want to thank Chris and Kathy and Ken, our counsel and our analyst. But more importantly, also their staff who are not here and who are often not seen by us. But many of them stayed a lot of late hours to help our counsel draft those amendments that we asked them to do. So we want to thank you so much for all the great work that you've done for the committee and on behalf of all the senators. And we are, Madam Chair, you may adjourn us.
Committee is adjourned.
Good job. It's been a longer 4 years, you know.